You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, let's get to a virus update. The president, as we mentioned, is expected to ask the Labor Department to put out a rule for employers with more than 100 employees to have a vaccine requirement or a testing requirement. This, according to NBC, he's set to announce a requirement also for all executive branch employees and federal contractors to be vaccinated. This is part of a renewed push to quell the pandemic, a person familiar said. Meanwhile, Delta Airlines said that a fifth of its unvaccinated employees received a COVID-19 shot in the 2 weeks since the airline announced that they would be subject to that $200 monthly surcharge. And Microsoft said it will not forecast a new date for a full reopening of its U.S. work sites. It had planned to start reopening in just about a month on October 4th. Let's get into it with Dr. David Dowdy, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He joins us on the phone from Baltimore. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Dowdy, it's great to have you on the show. Where do you think we are in terms of the Delta variant peaking here in the United States? Do we have to think about it regionally more so than as a kind of countrywide basis?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having it, Tim. And you know, I think the answer to the question is really yes and no. So there are definitely regional variations. We're seeing with the current surge that the rates in the South, for example, are about three to four times what they are in the Northeast. So there's definitely regional variation. At the same time, we're seeing the ups and downs be somewhat synchronized, right? So we're really seeing peaking in most areas of the country, not all, but most. And so I think that there's reason to be a little more optimistic going forward. We still have rates really high right now, but they are at least starting to level off in most places of the country.
Well, I think that idea of whether this variant is peaking or not is an important question when it comes to return to work. Do you think that it's getting to a point that people can safely come back and be together if they are vaccinated in mass at these major employers that are trying to do so?
Yeah, so I do think that we're probably a little bit too early to be talking about everyone coming back to work. Things are starting to peak and starting to look like they might be trending in the right direction, I think it's still important to remember that we, in this country, we still have over 100,000 people in the hospital right now, and those numbers are about as high as they've been this year. So we are starting to see things trending in the right direction, but I think it's still a little bit too early to be fully opening again. I mean, we need to get things down before we start to open fully back up.
But the difference between the people who are hospitalized with the virus right now and the people who were hospitalized in January are that the people who are hospitalized right now are not vaccinated. I guess that's not a difference because they weren't vaccinated in January, but the difference is we have vaccines available and the people who are hospitalized are not vaccinated.
So I think that's true. I mean, we are certainly seeing a separation between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, and of those people in the hospital, about 90% are unvaccinated, as you mentioned. So, but that being said, we are all in this together, and even among people vaccinated, right? Rates now. Of say hospitalization are not too different from that of the unvaccinated back in June, and that's not because of waning immunity or anything like that. It's just because we have so much transmission still going on right now, and so many people still sick.
Speaking of the differences of now between last year and now, the other point that employers keep trying to make to us is that the people who are in the hospital are largely those with pre-existing conditions. And so now it's a matter of being careful. What would you say to employers that are operating under that line of thinking?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. It is true in general that that people who are going to get sicker from this this disease are going to be people whose immune systems are weaker. So whether it's because they're older, they have underlying conditions, etc. That being said, we don't want to set up a precedent of discrimination in the workforce, right? And say that to work you have to have a fully functioning immune system, right? So I think that we do owe it to those who are at highest risk to try and do what we can to reduce transmission in the community as a whole.
So it raises the question, Dr. Dowdy, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, are vaccine mandates from corporations the right move?
Yeah, I think it's not a bad idea, right? I don't want to come out too strongly one way or the other, but I do think that if you want to make your workplace safe, having your workers get vaccinated is one thing you can certainly do.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. David Dowdy, infectious disease epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He joined us on the phone from Baltimore, the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropy. Shanali, I remember a few weeks ago we were thinking, okay, the fall is when we'd all be back in the office, and that certainly has changed.
Obviously, it's not how it worked out.
No. All right, we'll continue to bring you the latest. This is Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the simple flaw that sank Greensill's complex financial empire. It's a story available in Bloomberg.com and Bloomberg.com/businessweek, available now on the terminal as well. The former fintech darling took in money from investors seeking safety, and they used it for risky loans. It all collapsed in a crisis of confidence. Joining us now is Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins us on the remote access line from Brooklyn. Also, Luca DiPaoli, who wrote the story, Distressed Debt Reporter, joining us on the phone from London. He is with Bloomberg News. Joel, I want to start with you. What was the simple flaw that sank Greensill?
Well, so much of it was wrapped up in this company doing supply chain management that it was this opaque structure that they had, and they were able to get out over their skis by promising to do things that they really weren't doing. And I think the artificial intelligence capabilities that they claim to have were part of that. And what Luca has been, you know, obviously all over this story, which has, I think, been one of the most captivating kind of finance stories of the year. And we just kind of encourage him to keep going bigger and kind of try and wrap it all into a big, sweepy story so that you can understand that there have been twists and turns along the way. But ultimately, in the background was this flaw of basically over selling something that they didn't really have in practice. And so I want to hear more about that from Luca, and also hear about some of these new twists in the story, which some people might not be familiar with, including how it resonates in America, especially in West Virginia. So Luca, what do you feel? How well did I nail that flaw in mm-hmm. describing it?
I think that's pretty good. I mean, the disconnect here is ultimately between what Greenfield was selling. It sits in the middle, basically, right? So it's a non-bank lender, in effect, with a bank on the side. But you have clients, customers who want loans, and then in order to fund those loans, you do it by selling them on to someone else. And if you look at how the loans were described by some of the customers, they're very different to how they appear by Credit Suisse and the marketing documents around them. So somewhere between that chain of sort of Jim Justice and Sanjeev Gupta through Greensill and into Credit Suisse, there was a disconnect in what they were lending to customers and what they were selling on to investors.
It's a simple flaw, as you mentioned. And if they are able to have caught themselves in such a mess like this, what's there to be learned for other fintechs that may be suspect to similar flaws?
Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately, this is kind of pretty unusual. And I don't know if it's the same thing. There are lots of people who work in supply chain finance, which is a fairly sort of, it's not super old, but I mean, it's part of the broader world of trade finance, which has been going on for hundreds of years. But the really sort of strange and interesting thing they did was a different business altogether called Future Accounts Receivables Finance, which was essentially quite different from the lending which they were purporting to be doing, which is essentially lending to cover gaps in cash flows, you know, lending to make sure that invoices can be paid quicker but at a discount. And then it moves into Future Accounts Receivables Financing, and it becomes something quite different. And once you're starting to do that, you're taking on a different level of and, you know, as far as I can see from the documents that were shown to Credit Suisse investors, I'm not sure that they understood those risks.
Luca, I'm wondering what the status of Lex Greensill is right now. You do mention in this story that he hasn't been a target of any government investigations, but his life is changing. He used to have a fleet of 4 private planes. They'd trot the globe and they'd go to Bogota and Ibiza, Bangkok, Riyadh. What's he doing now?
So the last public appearance that Lex Greensill made was at an inquiry by lawmakers. I mean, this story had particular resonance in the UK due to some of the lobbying that went on, access to government loan schemes. And that involved a former prime minister from the UK, David Cameron, who was an advisor to the company. So he went in front of the select committee where he received, where we quote some of it in the story, where he received some pretty aggressive lines of questioning from the members of parliament who were there. But, I mean, the business itself is in various states of insolvency. There will be an attempt, I would imagine, to try and wind it up. But the real sort of loans, most of them, sit either in a bank in Germany, which Greensill bought, or they sit in funds run by Credit Suisse. And there will be an attempt to try and extract as much value from those loans as is possible. And that's something that's still ongoing. So that will take a long time. And we won't know sort of all the ins and outs of this for a long period, I would guess.
So you mentioned, I mean, I think one of the things the Greensill story has really been true of, and you mentioned this, is that it's so much of a European story. But the interesting thing in this particular story, Luca, is that you managed to connect it across the pond. So talk to us more about the justices and the West Virginia component of it, because it really does show the sort of how a supply chain management company can have this global these global implications.
Sure. So the justices have a business in West Virginia. It sells met coal, mostly to producers of steel. And Greensill extended a large line of financing to them. $70 million of that, which is supply chain finance, which, as I said, is the sort of humdrum, very normal business that a lot of banks do at scale. It's low margin, but people do it. And then the rest of it was in future account receivable financing, which is quite different. So the issue there is that rather than it being sort of an invoice where it's like, okay, well, I'm going to get paid my money at the end of the day because there's an invoice and, you know, some people might not pay it, but that's going to be relatively few and far between. It's based on things that haven't actually occurred yet, but future sales that may occur in the future. And the justice used this facility, I think, they had $850 million in total. It was about $780 million of future account receivables. And they describe it in their lawsuit, in their words, in this lawsuit that goes through their relationship with Greensill. Well, the issue now is that, as they have in an amended lawsuit later on said, they have personal guarantees. Well, three of the justice companies have personal guarantees.
Luca, we unfortunately have to leave it there. Luca DePaoli's distressed debt reporter, Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. It is a fantastic story that spans the globe. Everybody check it out. You can read Luca's story on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, a handful of Amazon stories that we want to get to this afternoon. The company is debuting a TV line, stepping up a fight with Roku, with Google, and more. Also, Amazon spending $1.2 billion on employee tuition and courses. Joining us now is probably the person who knows the most about Amazon when it comes to reporting, is Spencer Soper, technology and e-commerce reporter at Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Seattle. Spencer, excuse me, it's great to have you back on the show. A week ago, we were talking to you about another Amazon story that had labor shortage written all over it. That story was about Amazon encouraging its trucking companies, these last mile delivery companies, these independent contractors, not to test for marijuana. Now, Amazon out with the news today that the company is spending $1.2 billion on employee tuition and courses after Walmart and Target announced similar education perks. Is this all about attracting and retaining talent?
Yeah, that's all it is. There's basically a perks race. And so just like with the not testing people for marijuana was a way to expand the labor pool without necessarily raising wages, this is another way to offer a perk. It gets a lot of headlines. It can sound very appealing to people, but it's likely not as costly as raising wages. Only a portion of the people are going to take full advantage of the program.
It's so interesting because part of these training perks are in fields that don't apply to Amazon, like nursing and trucking, right?
Yeah, they've offered those for quite some time. Initially, Amazon, and that goes back several years, where they targeted high-demand industries. Trucking obviously would benefit Amazon, even if not directly employed by Amazon. Nursing, not as much. But Amazon said, if we're putting money into you, we want to make sure it's for a career that we know is in demand. Now it's more loose with the definitions and not necessarily just targeting those in-demand jobs. But it's basically just Amazon keeping up with the Joneses here.
Help me understand what the benefit is here. Why is it more beneficial for Amazon to put money into employees who are willing to retrain themselves for a career, including a career that might not be at Amazon, rather than to raise wages and retain people?
Well, one, it's probably going to cost less in terms of, you know, they're calibrating how many people actually participate. And then Amazon isn't really, in terms of the warehouse workers, it's not expecting people to stay 20, 30 years or anything. You know, if they can get 2-3 years out of you and you leave and then they plug someone else in, that's perfectly fine for Amazon, especially since they can reset wages on that new hire. So I think that for them, it can help with the churn, you know, try to reduce that churn. If someone comes in, even if they're not crazy about the job, but they're getting some sort of tuition-based support, that will compel them to remain for a period of time to continue with their schooling and then leave. Whereas if they don't have that incentive to stay at all, you know, people frequently will quit in the middle of their shift.
We got the JOLTS economic data yesterday from the Labor Department. And it shows that there is this mismatch when it comes to open positions and jobs available. And I'm wondering how Amazon is doing navigating that, because as you mentioned in this story, Walmart and Target have announced similar education perks. What's the talent war that's going on when it comes to Amazon hiring?
I mean, we'll see what their recruiting needs are for the fourth quarter and whether they're able to fill those positions. I mean, generally you will see them dial up the wages, and they could even do that geographically, so it won't necessarily be on a national scale. They will moderate their wages depending on the geographic market. But right now, yes, I mean, basically all employers are in the same position. They need to get people in to meet demand, and they're trying to find, you know, ways to do that without necessarily just pushing up wages, because once you give that higher wage, it's very difficult to take it back.
Hey, Spencer, I want to get to this other story just in the last 2 minutes that we have with you about Amazon selling a TV line, stepping up a fight with Roku and Google, the company introducing its first line of TVs today. It's going to sell a model, the Omni. It starts at $409 and a 4 Series, $369.99 and up, just in time for the holiday season. What's the strategy with these smart TVs here?
Well, I think you really have to look at it as Amazon's latest ploy to get voice activation into the home, and look beyond simply a TV. You know, they've really pushed their voice-activated speakers and really want to get those people, you know, more accustomed to using its voice-activated technology, the Alexa platform. And so this is simply another way to do that and have all of that baked into the television rather than relying on other companies to provide it in their TVs. So it's basically another step along that path. Amazon's really wants people to engage with its voice activation mm-hmm. platform, and it really wants a place in your home, because if you think, like, Google has the Android platform, you know, on mobile devices, and Apple has iPhones, Amazon really doesn't have that kind of connection with people, so it's hoping to make that connection in people's homes.
We only have about 30 seconds left here, but do you think Amazon can be successful in competing with others in the television business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they can offer an affordable, good quality television. Whether people engage with the voice activation is another question, but they have that long-term goal of wanting people to interact with it and potentially shop with it. That's their motivation. But they can absolutely be competitive. A lot of the question is going to be, you know, will they let people down? Because these things, generally, the low-cost televisions, there's limited supply.
Yeah, that's a really good point, especially one to end on. Spencer Soper, thank you so much for taking the time. Spencer is technology and e-commerce reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Seattle. Check out Spencer's latest story on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com about Amazon spending $1.2 billion on employee tuition. Also, Lucas Shaw's story about Amazon's new TVs. This is Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is the drive to the close. We are just over 10 minutes away from the close of trading on this Thursday, September 9th, 2021. U.S. equities lower across the board. The Dow down by 0.3%, as is the S&P 500. The NASDAQ lower by just about 0.1%. Let's get right into it with Noreen Beeman, president at Orion Advisor Solutions. There's over $50 billion in assets under management. Joins us on the phone from New Jersey. Noreen, how you doing? Noreen, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. How are you?
Oh, sorry. I'm doing great, and thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. Hey, on a day like today, where you see for much of the morning the S&P 500 in positive territory, and then drop into negative territory and just try to claw its way back into the green, what do you think what are investors really trying to digest?
There's so much news. When you think about what's going on, we're living still through this pandemic and the Delta variant, and then you see, you know, weather patterns all across the country and just updates on news. So I think what we're really facing is so much negative news, and then you see what's going on with the stimulus. So this is an opportunity for investors actually to just breathe through that and think through, like, what are their goals, what are their objectives, and really think about more of the long term and not make changes based on what's currently going on in the market environment.
Well, it is interesting because we are seeing on a day when, you know, we're talking about a fourth consecutive decline, to really keep things into perspective, right? The S&P 500 still year to date is up by 19.7%. Is there any room for it to go higher more this year?
I think we still have not seen the earnings growth that we're going to get once we come out of this pandemic. When you think of really, we've almost had so much stimulus that was put into the market that created this environment that the markets were still positive, but that earnings growth, I think we see going forward, will be really, I think, an opportunity to continue to go higher. But again, it's a multi-asset class portfolio. What are your goals? What are your objectives? What is the money's job? At the end of the day, the money has a job to do, and that's a particular interest for each individual investor.
In the next couple of months, we have a lot of headlines from Washington. There's a variant. How should investors be wary, and where should they be paying attention to what some of the negative catalysts might be for the market?
So when you think of negative catalysts, it's clearly with a lot of the news that is coming out of Washington, and there's going to be a lot of news, and we need to stay focused on what are the outcomes once they actually happen. There's going to be a lot of information that's going to be flowing prior to we actually get to a deal, whether we're looking at infrastructure, what are we looking at with the tax opportunities, so there may be changes to the tax code. So what are we looking at for there? Staying focused on what your end game is as an end investor and not really reacting. And even though, like we said, the markets have been up pretty significantly this year, what are your gains in your portfolio? How are you thinking about that going forward?
Hey, how should United investors in U.S. equities read into what the European Central Bank did, what President Christine Lagarde did with slowing the crisis stimulus, but saying, hey, this is not a taper?
You know, it's going to be interesting to watch what's going on in Washington and thinking about more of us as a global in this global environment. But I think we just have to take a moment to digest that and thinking through clearly what are the other parts of the economy that are going to be changing given all that's going on. It's an unprecedented experience that we're all living through. This pandemic has, oh my goodness, how much it's changed all of our lives. And how do you think we get through this and get out of the other side with that resiliency that we've learned over the past 18 months, almost 2 years?
Noreen, speaking of resilience, if the market does, say, hit a snag, that 5% or even 15% drop that some strategists are expecting, how should investors prepare themselves for something like that?
You know, I've been at this for over 32 years, and we've seen markets go up and markets go down. And if you continue with a good plan and you work through that process, you will come out the other side. Unfortunately, it's those bad decisions that are made behaviorally. That's one of the things that Orion we've done is we've brought behavioral finance into the model because we're thinking about how do we as individuals react. You know, the dynamic of an institutional investor doing better than the individual investor. Our job is to help kind of bridge that gap and keep that behavioral alpha in those portfolios and helping people not make bad decisions at the wrong time.
Can you talk a little bit about what you do at Orion Advisor Solutions? I think a lot of people might not be familiar with what wealth tech is and what wealth tech does.
What's exciting about what we're doing at Orion Advisor Solutions is, again, we have a little over $55 billion in assets under management, but we serve in assets under advisement, $1.7 trillion, and that's through our wealth tech. And it's really a matter of allowing the tools that digitize the experience, helping financial advisors. We work with financial advisors and helping them serve their end investor clients. And when you think about the tools that everyone uses today, those apps that we use to help improve our behaviors is one of those things that we're working on, is how do we get everything you need to know into an app that will allow you to make good investment decisions working with your financial advisor? How does it take that friction out of that experience? So the wealth tech opportunity now is pretty exciting, and I'm really glad to be a part of it.
Well, at the end of the day, does this wealth tech lower fees for consumers? I think when a lot of people talk to their financial advisors or even work with their banks, what they're finding is they hit a fee with their advisor, then they hit another fee when it comes to getting into some of these products, and in some cases, a third fee in between, depending on what product you get into. So some of this is very complicated for consumers. Can this be streamlined by any means through what you do?
So I think what's really important is full disclosure. You know, we come from a position of allowing you to understand what fees are being charged so that you as a consumer can make an informed decision. And, you know, fees are only an issue in absence of value, and I know that is very cliche, but when you think of behavior and you think of access, and I think that's what technology has done, it's really broken down barriers. Go back 20 years, go back 10 years, even back 2 years, we've broken down barriers to allow for more consumers to get better advice and be invested in the stock market.
Hey, Noreen, back to the markets. What's the next catalyst that sends stocks higher or lower? Is there anything that happens before the FOMC meeting later this month?
You know, I think we have to keep watching for the news out of Washington in terms of where are they going in terms of infrastructure, what's really going to happen, and how we pay for that. I think that's going to have some significant input to what's going on with the market. And then we'll have to see what happens post that meeting.
That meeting, this is what's complicated to me. And, you know, the smartest of investors are talking about it. How fragile is the stock market in relation to what happens with the Fed's decisions?
And Noreen, we only have about 30 seconds left.
I think that the markets will react in that day, and then they will start to see where the positive and negatives that they can take there. So I think we all should take a deep breath. We're going to see a lot of news coming out there. And I'm always one that if you stay the course, you put a good plan in place, that you just go after it and be patient.
A deep breath, always good advice no matter the scenario. Noreen Beeman, president at Orion Advisor Solutions. She's got over $50 billion in assets under management, joining us on the phone from New Jersey.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.